Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Sometimes you meet the most fascinating people on vacation. You just never know who you might encounter. People from different cultures, possible future lifelong friends, or even someone famous. There's also that chance of even meeting that special someone. In January 2002, a young German photographer named Janina was on holiday in Cancun, Mexico. She'd been enjoying the sand, surf, and sun when she was introduced to someone famous, Michael Finkel, an award-winning feature writer from the New York Times magazine. Recognizing her potential, Finkel quickly took the fledgling photographer under his wing, and Janina couldn't believe her fortune, because who couldn't use a bit of luck for their big break? It looked like Janina had just hit the jackpot. Together, Janina and Finkel spent their days exploring Mayan ruins and collaborating on stories he vowed to get published. But as time passed, a romance began to unfold. With their days filled with work and their nights filled with skinny-dipping rendezvous in the Caribbean Sea, it seemed like the most ideal location for a romance to start. So imagine Janine's surprise when one night, Frank was suddenly surrounded by a team of heavily armed Mexican police. Also there was a federal agent from the United States holding a copy of the FBI's 10 Most Wanted poster. And there on the poster were photos of the man claiming to be the writer from the New York Times. His face was the same, but the name on the poster was most definitely not Michael Finkel. Join me now as we examine the unbelievable case of Christian Longo, a middling con man whose greatest fear was being seen as average. You'll hear the devastating story of an innocent family swept up in a complex web of lies, only to be horrifically betrayed by the one person they trusted the most. It looked like the quintessential American vacation. Mom, dad, and three young children packed into a minivan, road tripping across the country. A well-stocked van with enough toys and books to keep the 1, 3, and 4-year-old entertained. But the best feature by far in this minivan was the rear seat movie screen and collection of kids' DVDs. If you spotted them driving past you in the fall of 2001, you'd have to smile at the portrait of American Pie wholesomeness. Proudly displayed on the back of the family's red Pontiac Montana was a Michigan vanity plate that read, Kid Van. But this wasn't an ordinary family vacation. At the wheel was 27-year-old Christian Longo, and beside him, his 34-year-old wife, Mary Jane. Neither of them knew exactly where they were going as they headed west on Interstate 90, only that they needed to go somewhere, far away from where they'd been, and hopefully their problems. Packed alongside the children's car seats, every square inch of storage was filled with the Longos' personal belongings. Early in their journey, Christian even decided to abandon the family dog on a farm in Minnesota to free up some more room. Zachary, the oldest child, bore a strong resemblance to his father with his ruddy complexion and light red hair. Christian remembers the 4-year-old's fascination when they stopped to see Old Faithful in Yellowstone. He also remembers how 3-year-old Sadie attempted to give every single prairie dog an aim as they continued driving further west. One-year-old Madison was never far from Mary Jane, practically attached to her hip at all times. But as she approached her second birthday, Madison had started showing the first signs of childlike independence, like not sitting right next to her mother at dinner time, and she was exceedingly proud of her newfound accomplishments in that adorable way that only toddlers can be. By the time the Longos reached the Oregon coast, the family only had a few hundred dollars to their name. In desperate need of money, they pawned off Mary Jane's diamond engagement ring for a measly $600. On September 11, 2001, as the whole world watched in horror as terrorists attacked the World Trade Center, Christian Longo's primary focus was finding a place for his family to live. Eventually, they moved into a condominium in the town of Newport, Oregon. Although they couldn't afford it, Christian decided that if he couldn't come up with the money for rent, they'd simply skip out of paying and move on. Meanwhile, Christian got a job at a local Starbucks, making $7.40 an hour. At the same time, Mary Jane and their three children became regular fixtures around town, spending hours a day at the public library and their afternoons at the McDonald's play place. Anything to keep the kids entertained that didn't cost any money. During their time in Newport, the Longos quickly became close friends with one of Christian's co-workers, Denise Thompson, who had children of similar ages of her own. Their kids often played together, and Denise was always happy to babysit occasionally. On December 15th, Denise babysat the Longo children while Christian and Mary Jane went out for dinner and a movie. The next time she saw the children was on TV. On the morning of December 19th, 2001, a man noticed something floating in an estuary near the town of Waldport, about 15 minutes south of the Longo's condo. It was the lifeless body of a young boy, clothed only in his underwear. Police did everything they could to determine the boy's identity, but when the child's description failed to match any local missing person reports, they released a computer-generated image of the boy to local news. When Denise Thompson saw the image on December 21st, she immediately recognized the boy as Zachary Longo and contacted police. On December 22nd, a team of divers began searching the estuary's waters near a bridge that spanned it, and it was there they found their first clue. A pillowcase with a very large rock inside of it weighing it down to the bottom. Not knowing first what to make of it, the divers continued their search, and soon, the gut-wrenching truth would become all too apparent. Peering through the murky waters, divers discovered the body of Sadie Longo. Tied to her ankle was a pillowcase with a large rock inside. There was no longer any question about the purpose of the first pillowcase and where the body of the young boy had floated away from. Denise Thompson had the unenviable task of identifying the bodies for authorities.
Last Saturday, divers found the body of 3-year-old Sadie Ann Longo in the Alsea Bay. Days earlier, her brother Zachary had washed ashore. Since then, police boats have searched the Alsea River for clues to their murders. All the while, Christian, Mary Jane, and Madison Longo remained missing.
Although the other members of the Longo family were technically considered missing, police feared the worst. Then, 5 days later, detectives searching the waters of Yerquina Bay outside the Longo's home made another grisly discovery. Sunk beneath the docks of the marina were two green suitcases.
Late in the afternoon, investigators pulled an adult-sized body out of Yerquina Bay. Moments later, divers went back in and retrieved a second body about the size of a small child. Authorities say these may very well be the bodies of Mary Jane Longo and her 2-year-old daughter, Madison.
Still, there was no sign of Christian Longo himself, and the red family minivan was also conspicuously missing. Police considered the possibility that Christian could also be a victim. but they soon found evidence, leading them to believe they might never find Christian at all. At least, not in the water. Eventually, a witness came forward with a chilling story. On the morning of December 17, 2001, around 4:30 a.m., he'd seen a red minivan parked on the estuary bridge and even asked the driver if he needed any help. When the driver said no, the man went on his way. But he now believed the driver was most likely Christian Longo. Police then learned that Christian had been spotted around town in the days after his son's body was discovered on the 19th. In fact, he'd gone to work that day and had lunch with Denise Thompson, where he told her that Mary Jane had left him for another man, taking the children with her. The following day, Christian went to work again, and on Friday the 21st, went in to pick up his final paycheck. It was around this same time that some housekeepers at a local motel found several suspicious trash bags inside their dumpster. Inside the bags were hoards of personal belongings from the Longos family photo albums, baby clothes, women's clothes, and Mary Jane Longo's photo ID. Police were quickly becoming convinced that Christian wasn't a victim. Instead, he had become their primary suspect. After putting out an APB for the Longo family minivan, they immediately got a hit. A car dealership 2 hours north of Newport had reported a theft of a brand new Dodge Durango. Apparently, a customer had simply hopped inside a showroom model, turned the key, and drove off. Employees at the dealership just assumed someone must have approved a test drive, but they were wrong. But conveniently, the thief had left behind his old red minivan right there in the dealership lot. And even though the thief had completely removed the license plate, years of dirt and dust buildup clearly revealed what the letters had been: K-I-D-V-A-N. Police were now certain Christian Longo was on the run. Eventually, police tracked down Christian's stolen Durango, finding it abandoned in a parking lot at the San Francisco airport. The implications weren't lost on authorities. A man suspected of murdering his entire family had been able to successfully go on the run, get himself to an airport, and had most likely fled the country. By now, he could be practically anywhere in the world. But for law enforcement, the search for Christian had become an all-hands-on-deck situation, with the FBI leading the way. And for a brief moment, Christian Longo was on the FBI's notorious 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list, right there next to Osama bin Laden. Mary Jane Baker was 23 years old when she first met 16-year-old Christian Longo in the town of Ypsilanti, Michigan, just outside Ann Arbor. From the first minute Christian laid eyes on Mary Jane, he knew he was in love. Even though she was quite a bit older than him, Christian thought she was the most perfect woman he'd ever seen, and he never imagined the feelings might be returned one day. As fellow Jehovah's Witness members, Mary Jane and Christian frequently crossed paths during church events, and by the time Christian turned 18, he and Mary Jane realized they'd fallen in love. Before long, Christian purchased a diamond engagement ring on a payment plan and proposed to his future wife. With his only source of income coming from a job at a small camera shop, it didn't take long for Christian to find himself strapped for cash between ring payments and monthly rent payments. So Christian decided to steal $108 from his work in order to help him make his payments. Although he confessed the next day to his crime and quit his job, this was probably the first of a series of really bad decisions Christian would make. It had been an auspicious start to the couple's relationship, and although Mary Jane completely disapproved of what Christian had done, they were able to work through it and got married in 1993. After the wedding, Christian and Mary Jane moved into a modest apartment in Ypsilanti. Before long, The landlord noticed Christian moving in some luxury items, like a pool table, a giant TV, and brand new furniture. He even started driving an expensive SUV. But the landlord never wondered how he could afford it all, because Christian told him he worked for the New York Times, which wasn't exactly true. The truth was, he'd taken a job working for one of the paper's distributors. Basically, he was a paper boy and was now living way beyond his means. But you know that saying, fake it till you make it? It seemed perhaps Christian was living by that mantra, because soon he began working his way up the ladder and became a supervisor, then a manager. He was actually making the kind of money he'd been pretending to make. The only problem was, the more he earned, the more he spent. The newlyweds treated themselves to luxury vacations, expensive dinners, and whatever toys they wanted, living right on the edge of financial feasibility. At the moment, they didn't have any real need to save for a rainy day, because for now, the skies were perfectly clear. In February 1997, the Longos welcomed their firstborn child into the world, a son they named Zachary. The very next year, their daughter Sadie was born in April, and baby Madison was born in the fall of 1999. 3 kids in 3 years, and just like that, the Longos had one big happy family. But on the horizon, the rain clouds had already started to gather. It all started when Christian decided to quit his management job, the position that had been funding his upper middle class lifestyle. But for good reason. The very next day after Sadie was born in 1998, his company ordered him to fly out to San Francisco to help distribute newspapers during a worker strike. The assignment was mandatory, and they didn't care that Christian had just welcomed a newborn infant home. That was just tough luck. After a week out in California, Chris quit his job and flew back to Michigan to be with his family. It was an honorable decision, but honor doesn't pay the bills. Chris's next job was selling fireplaces to home builders. Most of his income was commission-based, and he quickly realized that the pay was far worse than the employers had led him to believe. Even so, Christian never adjusted his spending habits, leasing cars and boats, and continuing on vacations. The Longos were now living almost entirely on credit cards, 14 to be exact, and soon they were maxed out and missing payments. Mary Jane's car was even repossessed. But Christian had a solution. During his tenure selling fireplaces, he realized there was a giant opportunity in the home building marketplace. These home builders desperately needed cleaning services to prepare the homes for sale. So Christian started his own, a company called Final Touch, and the business was an immediate success. In fact, there was more work than he could possibly handle. And as the business grew, he hired more and more employees until he had around 60 on the payroll. There was just one problem. Building contractors notoriously take forever to pay their outstanding invoices. So despite billing out tens of thousands of dollars to these contractors, he was left waiting for payments to come through. Meanwhile, he was spending every last penny he had on overhead. The business was a surefire cash cow, but none of it would matter if he went bankrupt before he even got his feet on the ground. The worst part for Christian was that the prospect he might look like a failure to his friends, to his family, and even his fellow Jehovah's Witnesses. But there was one person whose opinion of him meant more than all the others, Mary Jane. And as far as Mary Jane was concerned, everything was going perfectly with their finances. With Christian in control of the family's money, he just swore to her they were doing fine, and she believed him. To prove it to her, Christian did something dramatic. He stole a car, but not just any car. It had to be the top of the line, fully decked out kind of vehicle, a red family minivan Mary Jane had always wanted. It even had a pull-down TV screen for the kids and a price tag of $35,000. How he managed to get the minivan was, frankly, a little ingenious. In February 2000, Christian created a fake Michigan driver's license using a false name. The ruse was simple. He went to a car dealership with the fake license, handed it over to the sales agent, and asked to take the minivan for a test drive. After handing over the keys, he simply hopped in the van and took off, never to return. But here's where it gets clever. Christian then ordered a vanity plate for his own personal vehicle, the one legally registered to him. The new plates read, Kid Van. In Michigan at the time, whenever police scanned a license plate, it didn't report back the make or model of the vehicle, only the registered owner. So if he ever did get pulled over in the minivan, it would come back as being registered to him. This would go down as the single most successful con Christian Longo ever pulled. But it was far from his last. When Christian brought home the minivan, Mary Jane was beyond thrilled. Not only was it the car she wanted, it was also proof that Christian was delivering on his promises to provide for the family. In that moment, she was on cloud nine, but soon, she'd tumble back down to earth when she learned Christian had fallen in love with one of his employees, a woman named Jennifer. Although it's not believed Christian and Jennifer had become intimate, an exchange of emails between them seemed to prove at least an emotional affair. One of the emails from Christian read, "You have changed my life. It had no real meaning, no lasting laughter, and no joy. It has come back. I love you, and am deeply in love with you, and always will be." The affair almost ended the Longos' marriage, but eventually, they were able to repair it. Christian promised Mary Jane he'd never lie again, but this was the biggest lie he ever told. By June of 2000, Christian's cleaning business was on the verge of bankruptcy, with employees becoming enraged when their paychecks started bouncing. Feeling desperate, Christian came up with another scheme. He printed off a series of fraudulent checks in the name of a contractor who allegedly still owed him tens of thousands of dollars. Making sure that each of the fake checks matched a legitimate outstanding invoice, Christian took them to the bank and deposited them. All the checks cleared, $17,000 worth, and now he was able to make payroll. In his view, this wasn't stealing. It was money that was rightfully owed to him, and while this may be true, it doesn't make what he'd done any less illegal. In the coming weeks, Christian continued depositing more and more fraudulent checks to keep his company above water. Yet, despite being in such incredible financial straits, Christian still decided to buy a pair of jet skis and took the family on vacation. It was like he was addicted to spending money he simply didn't have. He even lied to Mary Jane, claiming he'd won the jet skis in a raffle. But no worry, if he needed more money, he'd just forge some more checks. Until a few weeks later, when the bank got wise, and Christian was arrested, fined $30,000, and placed on probation for 3 years. This would be the beginning of the end for Final Touch, and Christian eventually went back to his old job as a paperboy, which wasn't going to cut it anymore. Christian now owed way too many people money and couldn't pay any of his bills. But did any of this make Christian curb his spending? Nope. Instead, Christian forged his own father's signature to take out 2 new credit cards and then bought himself scuba gear and other toys. By the time his parents learned what he'd been doing, they wanted to prosecute, and they weren't alone. Christian was now being sued by a number of banks, former employees whose checks had bounced, and other businesses he'd also screwed over. Breaking the terms of his probation, Christian and Mary Jane packed their kids up into their minivan and fled across the Michigan border to Toledo, Ohio. There they rented a rundown warehouse without plumbing, a temporary hideout from all of Christian's creditors. Not an ideal place for 3 young children. Soon, the Longos decided to skip town without paying rent on the warehouse and loaded up the kid van again, hitting the highway, hoping all their problems were in the rearview mirror. But that's not how problems work. Not the kind Christian had caused anyway. Christian was now a wanted man with warrants out for his arrest. He was breaking probation, and by that point, even more fraudulent checks had been discovered. Not to mention, they were now crossing the country in a stolen vehicle. In September 2001, Mary Jane's family reported her as a missing person. But when the family received handwritten postcards from Mary Jane herself, police quickly took her off the missing persons database. It's impossible to say what was going through Christian and Mary Jane's minds at the time as they raced out west. Did they feel like Bonnie and Clyde? Or had Christian convinced Mary Jane everything was going to be okay, that he could take care of it, and that it was all just one big misunderstanding? It's even possible to conceive that a con man like Christian had convinced his wife that he was the good guy in this situation. According to Christian, Mary Jane was completely in the dark when it came to most of the illegal schemes. She didn't know he'd skipped out on the warehouse rent or that he'd forged credit cards in his father's name, and she certainly didn't know how her beloved kid van had been stolen. Basically, she only knew about the things he'd been caught doing and forced to admit. But still, what was Christian's endgame? He was certainly smart enough to understand that his debts and arrest warrants wouldn't simply vanish just because he switched time zones. Prosecutors would later contend that Christian had planned his family's murders long before they'd even reached the West Coast. The entire trip out to Oregon was just a part of his grand scheme to get rid of his family and free himself from the responsibilities, obligations, and the mountain of problems he'd created for himself. In the wake of murdering his family, it appears Christian believed the bodies wouldn't be discovered, at least not as quickly as they were. He told friends and co-workers that Mary Jane had left him for another man, taking the children with her. But when the bodies started turning up, fleeing the country became his only option. To fund his escape, Christian stole credit card details from a customer's receipt at work. He then drove the family minivan to a car dealership and then stole a brand new SUV by driving it off the showroom floor. It had worked before. Why wouldn't it work again? Christian then drove down to San Francisco, where he booked a flight to Mexico using the stolen credit card number. He was inside the terminal at the exact same time the bodies of Mary Jane and Madison were found in suitcases by the divers. After arriving in Cancun, Mexico, Christian knew he'd have to come up with an alias. But instead of inventing a brand new identity, he pretended to be someone who actually existed and was alive. A very real person with the type of successful career he'd always fancied himself having. That's when Christian began introducing himself as Michael Finkel, a feature writer for the New York Times magazine. Over the years, Christian had followed Michael's career, reading many of his articles, so much so, Christian was easily able to pass himself off as the real Michael Finkel during conversations. He even used this identity to con a beautiful young German photographer into a budding new romance. But he only got to be Michael Finkel for a couple of weeks. The FBI tracked him down and arrested Christian on January 13th, 2002.
K2 was first to report the news. One of the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives is in custody.
Accused family killer Christian Longo is in a Houston, Texas jail tonight. The 27-year-old Longo arrived at Bush Intercontinental Airport this morning, accompanied by FBI agents. Longo was arrested by Mexican authorities and the FBI last night at a beach resort in Mexico.
Once we had realized the youth hostel that he had been staying in Cancun, inquiry there determined that he had been asked to leave and left sometime around January 7th.
Longo was asked to leave following reports of money stolen from guests. Longo had talked of going to Tulum, about 60 miles south of Cancun. His accommodations were primitive there, a grass hut on the beach. Sunday night, a little after 6, 20 Mexican police and FBI agents surrounded Longo. His run ended.
He voluntarily agreed to accompany the FBI agents to the airport, where he got on a Continental Airlines jet and flew from Cancun to Houston.
Christian Longo's flight from justice was officially over, but this is where the story takes an interesting turn. In the weeks following Christian's arrest, the real Michael Finkel's life was being turned upside down. He'd been caught fabricating a story for the New York Times magazine and passing it off as truth. He was actually fired because of it, disgraced, becoming a pariah among journalists. But in February 2001, he learned that one of America's most wanted fugitives had been pretending to be him while on the run in Mexico. And now that the real Finkel was out of a job, with plenty of time on his hands, he decided to reach out to Christian Longo in jail. Before long, the two men became pen pals, with Christian sending him more than 1,000 handwritten pages worth of letters to Finkel, telling him his life story. In those letters, Christian never admitted to murdering his family. In fact, he claimed to be innocent, never really explaining what really happened to Mary Jane and the kids. Instead, he'd say, it would have to wait for trial. Michael Finkel would eventually write a book about the bizarre convergence between the lives of a disgraced journalist and an unforgivable murderer in a book called True Story, which also turned out to be a major source for this episode. The book would also eventually be turned into a movie starring Jonah Hill and James Franco. As the prosecutors prepared for Christian's upcoming trial, they discovered a startling revelation. To them, it was obvious Christian had been planning his family's murder for quite some time. The prosecution would argue it all began when Mary Jane discovered Christian's affair nearly 2 years earlier, combined with his financial ruin and fall from grace in the eyes of his local church. All of these reasons had made Christian determined to get rid of his family and start a new life without them. The proof of premeditation, they argued, was corroborated by some damning information Christian had downloaded onto his computer while living in the Toledo warehouse. It was a book titled Hitman, which purported itself to be an instruction book on murder. Inside were instructions on how to properly submerge a dead body so it wouldn't be found. They also discovered another book called Modern Identity Changer, and it was obvious Christian had already employed some tips from the book. Once Christian got to Oregon, he began the process of securing a new identity. Police had discovered an obituary he'd printed out from a local newspaper, and handwritten on the page was the man's social security number. Using an online resource, Christian discovered that the man's death hadn't been reported to Social Security, something that's surprisingly common. That meant the number was still completely valid, and Christian could use it to create a brand new identity with a working Social Security number. This all happened in the months prior to his family's murder. But when it came to the murders themselves, the prosecution was forced to speculate and create their best theory based on the evidence they'd collected. They argued that Christian murdered all four of his family members inside the condominium during the early morning hours of December 17, 2001. Their theory was that Christian attacked Mary Jane first, strangling her violently with his bare hands, a theory corroborated by the wounds and bruises discovered during her autopsy. The prosecution then argued Christian murdered his three children one by one in a similar fashion. After disposing of Mary Jane and Madison inside of a suitcase at the marina, Christian then drove 12 miles in the minivan to a bridge where he dumped the other two bodies, tying pillowcases filled with rocks to the children's ankles to keep them submerged. But then on December 17th at 4:30 a.m., a witness who just happened to drive over the same bridge as Christian spotted him and asked him if he needed roadside assistance. The The trial of Christian Longo was set to start on March 10, 2003. Up until this point, Christian had pled not guilty on all four counts of homicides. But just before the trial, Christian shocked everyone when he entered a very strange plea. Guilty, but only to the murders of Mary Jane and Madison, not Sadie and Zachary. Even the best legal minds were completely baffled. It didn't make any sense. Let's just say, if he were somehow acquitted for Sadie and Zachary's murders, he still would have been facing the death penalty for Mary Jane and Madison's. But the world would soon learn why Christian Longo had one more lie he wanted to tell, and he wanted everyone to hear it. Taking a stand in his own defense, Christian gave his explanation for the night of the murders. According to him, he decided to come clean to Mary Jane about all the illegal things he'd done and never told her about. That's when she became apoplectic and kicked him out of their bedroom, forcing him to sleep in the living room. The next day, December 18th, Christian said he went to work, but while he was there, claimed Mary Jane went crazy and murdered the children, dumping their oldest two into the water. He said it was when he came home from work that he found Madison unresponsive in her mother's bed. According to him, Mary Jane told him, "You did this. You killed us." That's when Christian claimed he killed Mary Jane in heated retaliation. It was afterward, he said, he realized Madison was still breathing and on the brink of death, so he suffocated her. In his testimony, he framed it as an act of mercy. In a fitting twist of irony, Christian's final day of testimony fell on April Fool's Day, and there wasn't a single person inside the courtroom who believed a word that came out of his mouth. Within minutes of deliberation, the jury unanimously agreed on the guilty verdict. Ultimately, Christian Longo would be given a sentence of death for his unspeakable crimes. But in 2022, Oregon's governor decided to commute the sentences of all death row inmates to life in prison without parole, a decision that outraged Mary Jane's family. Her sister Penny spoke with Portland's KGW News about the family's reaction.
You know, Penny Baker Dubé got a phone call she wasn't expecting yesterday morning. An Oregon State employee called with, quote, bad news. The man who killed her sister and their three young children would be removed from death row, and she'd have no say in the matter. It was a done deal.
No one should have that power.
Penny Baker Dubé feels hurt and betrayed after Oregon's governor announced she would commute the sentences of all 17 inmates on Oregon's death row to life in prison without the possibility of parole. That means convicted killers like Christian Longo, who murdered Dubé's sister and their three young children, will be spared the death penalty.
This isn't someone receiving a sentence unjustly that may be innocent. This is someone that deserves to die for what they've done. If anyone deserves to die for their crime, it is Chris. Before this happened, I did not have an opinion on the death penalty. I did not feel that that was my decision to make about anyone. After this happened, I have an opinion on the death penalty. Chris deserves to be dead for what he did. My family will never feel safe until Chris is no longer a part of this world.
Up until after his sentencing, Christian continued his correspondence with writer Michael Finkel, and in a subsequent letter, finally confessed to murdering his entire family. In recent years, Christian's case has drawn comparisons to another infamous familicide, the case of Christopher Watts, who murdered his pregnant wife and two young children in 2018 after his wife discovered he'd been having an affair. He too first said he'd only killed his wife after she'd murdered the children. Typically, family annihilators are men, often in their 30s, who under the crushing weight of personal and financial pressures, commits the unthinkable act of taking the lives of their own family members. Even still, there simply aren't any good explanations for why these fathers don't simply leave without annihilating their entire families. Despite Christian's incredibly long rap sheet and history of crimes, Not a single one of them had ever involved violence of any kind. There were also no apparent signs in his past to suggest he could have been a calculated pre-planned killer. During the intensely emotional sentencing hearing, the judge even addressed the inexplicable nature of Christian's crimes. From the bench, he said, "This case has brought on more tears to this courtroom from witnesses in 1 month than I've perceived in a decade. This case is about the extraordinary harm one person intentionally caused for reasons which today, still today, mystify me." Mary Jane's family shared with the court the profound loss they'd suffered. Mary Jane's sister Sally recounted cherished memories of the children and imagined the ones they would have created if they hadn't tragically been stolen, like graduations, weddings, and watching them all grow up. Her sister Penny described Mary Jane as the kind of beautiful person that she strives to be, and that Mary Jane did it without effort. She said that many people talk of closure. There is no closure. Mary Jane, Zachary, Sadie, and Madison are gone. Emotionally and physically, I'll never be the same. And now I would like to introduce to you a new true crime history podcast from the studio behind the hits American Scandal and American History Tellers called American Criminal.
American Criminal is a new true crime podcast from the studio behind American Scandal and American History Tellers. Every week, you'll fall deeper into the riveting stories of the country's most clever, craven, and cruel criminals. Fraud, theft, murder, and worse. Whatever the case, whoever the criminal, you don't know the whole story until now. The debut season tackles one of the most sensational cases of the 20th century, the Menendez murders. In 1989, young Lyle and Eric Menendez brutally shot their own parents. Prosecutors and the press said it was a multi-million dollar inheritance that led two greedy rich kids to murder. But the picture-perfect facade this Hollywood family built hid troubling abuse. Could these teenagers have been driven to kill? Or was it even in self-defense? Listen now. Go to AmericanCriminal.com or search for and follow American Criminal wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @madnesspod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.